This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We'll chat with a composer today whose last name is Schoenberg. His first initial is A. No, I have not resurrected one of the most influential composers of the 20th century in Arnold Schoenberg. Rather, I'll chat with American composer Adam Schoenberg. Quickly becoming one of the most widely commissioned and performed living American composers, he's still in his 30s. He's a member of the Atlanta School of Composers, and after studies at Oberlin and Juilliard, he now resides in Los Angeles, where he is assistant professor of composition at Occidental College. His works have been in demand by top orchestras across the country, and he's found a real champion with a maestro you hear here every month, Michael Stern, and the Kansas City Symphony, who perform on a new CD just released of his orchestral music. And you're listening to a piece that really put my guest on the map, his Finding Rothko, inspired by the artwork of Mark Rothko. Each movement explores the wonders of Mr. Rothko's painting. You're hearing the first movement, Orange, and we'll follow that with the final movement, Wine. Michael Stern leads the Kansas City Symphony. I spoke with Adam Schoenberg by phone a few weeks back. I'm very happy to be speaking with composer Adam Schoenberg. The reason we're talking right now is this new CD. Congrats on the new recording of orchestral works on the Reference Recording label. And I know on this label you're working with Maestro Michael Stern and the Kansas City Symphony. Our listeners know Maestro Stern from our monthly broadcasts of his Iris Orchestra, which broadcast a piece of yours a little bit later. And we'll get to Michael Stern later, if that's okay. But I'm just wondering, the CD of your orchestral works, it's a very cool milestone. Did it come together quickly? Was this thing in the brewing for a while? I mean, is this something you had a little bit of signpost in your career to make this happen? I'm just curious about the actual birth of this CD.
Sure. The CD that you now have took a really long time to be birthed into the world. We actually recorded in June of 2014. So it took 2.5 years to officially get released. But in terms of the project coming about, the timing worked out well in that I was serving as the composer in residence of the Kansas City Symphony at the time.
Right.
And as you know, with Michael and Iris, you know, Michael was the very first person to commission an orchestral piece from me, which of course was Finding Roscoe.
Right.
And so he really has been such a great champion. And Kansas City had commissioned American Symphony and Picture Studies, and we basically had enough music to do an entire album. And then Frank Byrne, the president, and Michael decided that this was a project they wanted to take on. And at that point, it happened very quickly in terms of us knowing that it was actually going to become a reality.
Yeah, and it's great for our listeners because we heard even another piece, which was your concerto uniquely for the Trio Project Trio, Scatter, right? That was the name of it?
Oh, yeah. I'm very happy with that piece, and I hope that can get recorded at some time.
Yeah.
A very different piece from Roscoe, of course.
But, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Now, two of the three works on this program draw inspiration from visual arts or visual artists. You mentioned Finding Roscoe, of course, Mark Roscoe. And the other piece, the Picture Studies, which is kind of a 21st century take on Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition. Instead of putting into music one artist's paintings, which is what Mussorgsky did, most of the movements in the work have to deal with either specific piece of visual art, but by different artists. So a number of questions off of that. How did the piece first come about? It's a little bit odd for a 21st century composer to do this, especially with the Mussorgsky sitting there. So how did the whole idea of it or the genesis of that come about?
So Finding Roscoe really, in many ways, put me on the map in the classical orchestral world when it was premiered. And because it was based on a visual artist, Kansas City Symphony, they have a relationship with the Nelson Atkins Museum, which is a fabulous museum in Kansas City. And they were looking to partner and create some type of new work, essentially a 21st century pictures at an exhibition. And I know that both organizations were looking at a few different composers. But I think just because of the success of Roscoe and my relationship with Michael, they decided to commission me and have me do that piece. So yeah, it's absolutely unusual to write, you know, a so-called 21st century pictures at an exhibition because Mussorgsky's version for piano and, of course, Ravel's orchestration is such a monumental and famous work. Why do something in that, you know, style, I suppose? And so it was intimidating at first, but you know, I live in Los Angeles, and of course, I'm interested in scoring for film and TV, and I've had a little bit of success, not that much. I've done two independent features, and so I've always been interested in image and music. And so it was a great challenge to take on. And in terms of the piece, I wanted to honor Mussorgsky. And so actually half of the movements that are set to artwork, there are 10 movements, but 8 of them are actually based on art pieces. And so 4 of those 8 movements I wrote as piano etudes first.
Oh, okay.
And then orchestrated them. So I wanted to sort of pay an homage to Mussorgsky somehow, but of course make it my own piece as well.
You're Mussorgsky and Ravel both in the same body at the same time.
Yeah, actually, yeah, totally true.
This is interesting. Did the museum allow you to pick which pieces of art you would set? Because this is quite a range here of visual artists who are portrayed in your music.
Yeah, and I ended up definitely going with more of a 20th century approach overall. No, I mean, you know, the main difference I always tell people when getting a commission to write an orchestral piece versus a film score, you know, with an orchestral commission, generally speaking, you have complete freedom and liberty to express yourself unless there's a very specific theme or a person they want you to honor. Whereas a film score, you are at service first and foremost to the image, and then secondly to the director and the producers, and it's a much more collaborative process. And so I was very fortunate in the sense that both the Kansas City Symphony, and the Nelson Atkins Museum really wanted me to come up with the artist who I found myself being most drawn to, you know, because they have this very extensive East Asian collection, which is super beautiful. But as I started exploring that collection, it just didn't feel intuitively right to me in terms of what I wanted to set.
Sure.
And so, you know, I basically scoured the museum for a long time. I took, I think, 3 or 4 trips in total over the course of a year, or at least over 8 months before selecting the final images that were going to become the piece. So there was a lot of freedom and flexibility to find the images that were most meaningful to me, I guess you could say.
It's interesting because everybody thinks, you know, the Mozart model of just writing and it's finished. Were there a number of pieces you thought of, or pieces of artwork I'm talking about, for inspiration, and then decided, like you said, that Asian wing just not going to work? Or were you pretty, the list you came up with pretty much worked for you musically? You just had to make it happen.
Yeah, great question. I'd say probably 90% of the initial artwork that I selected became the final product. There were a few pieces that I was interested in setting, but there was some type of, if I recall correctly, I think there was a copyright issue in terms of whether or not we were going to be able to even use those images, because part of the collaboration with the Nelson Atkins Museum at the premiere back in 2013, the museum helped create this gorgeous program book that had all of the images replicated for the audience to see. And so I think there was some type of printing permission that they had to go through as well. And a couple of the initial pieces of art that I was super fascinated by, it became somehow problematic.
It's very ironic that copyright legalities will get in the way of art, but not the visual art, but the musical art being created on it. I think that's just very funny. Sorry.
I mean, every time Finding Roscoe is formed and an orchestra wants to project the images, they have to go to the Artists' Rights Society in New York City and obtain permission and pay a licensing fee. So there's all these steps that have to happen.
Once again, from the new release of my guest Adam Schoenberg's orchestral music on the Reference Recordings label, from his Picture Studies, the opening intro, then jumping to the Kandinsky movement, inspired by that artist's painting Rose with Gray, Michael Stern leads the Kansas City Symphony. We'll be right back. Last question on this piece, but then also throw in the Rothko. When you do works like this, which are basically, in some way, they're not programmatic, but they are projecting music onto extra musical things, in this case, visual art, are you ever worried that your perception of how this should be musically, because there's something else that people can look at and say, this is what it means to me, is not how it lines up with the audience? I know it's a little clumsy way I've worded that question, but you get my idea, that your idea of Kandinsky is not what the audience is thinking of, you know, type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of the day, I've tried to make it as clear as possible, at least when speaking from the stage, when I helped talk about the piece before the world premiere, is that I'm not specifically trying to set the images to music, like as an entire entity. To me, they really were almost my muse and giving musical inspiration. And that at the end of the day, I think the piece has to be successful on its own without even seeing the image. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if you do get to see the image, you can see how I responded to the artwork. So, of course, I mean, that's the beauty of art in general. There is, you know, a certain aesthetic, a certain subjectivity, and how I may have set one of the Rothko pieces in Finding Rothko, some audience member may think that that was the complete wrong type of, you know, music texture. And same with picture studies. But that's just something I guess you have to face.
Yeah, it is. When you go outside of that and you go to something where someone has another tangible way to look at what you're putting into music. Yeah, that is, you know. And go to the other piece on the CD, because I think as risky as we just sort of talked about what you just did with the visual art, this is even bolder. Calling this piece American Symphony, which is what every major American composer in the mid-20th century was trying to write, the American Symphony, and just titling this. So again, just start at the beginning of this, the inspiration for doing this, the layout of what you were going to cover in this, and then the boldness of just grabbing that title, which frankly, I mean, you're not 40 yet. You've got a lot of years to compose and write and have a great career. By calling this American Symphony, unless you're going to have a string of them, Son of, or American Symphony 2 or whatever. I mean, this is what you've titled it. So take us through that whole thing with this work. So.
Sure. And it's funny, you know, I guess it's 2017 now, and I think, was it premiered in 2011? I started conceiving the piece in 2008, so it's been around for a while.
Yeah.
And I was very, very self-conscious and insecure and worried about the initial title. And then eventually I just learned to let go and accept the fact that this really mattered to me. So to take you through the story, you know, the 2008 presidential election was really the first election of my adult life that I very much felt a part of. And of course, personally, yes, I was a fan of Obama, but to me, it wasn't a political piece. And I think each person of every party was wanting change. And after the election, 3 nights after the election, I was living in Miami at the time, and I heard the New World Symphony perform Aaron Copland's Symphony No. 3 live for the very first time. It's a piece that I have studied inside out and analyzed, but I actually never got to experience the work live in concert. And it was this really profound experience for me. And when the piece ended, I immediately just had this feeling inside myself, which was telling me that it's my civic duty to try to bring more beauty into our world. We just had this election. What can I do to make our country a better and safer place? And for me, the greatest way I can do that is, of course, naturally through music. And then at that point, it became, what type of piece am I going to write? And so as a 21st century composer, just the idea of calling a piece a symphony, I think, comes with certain connotations or certain expectations. And really the more philosophical question, I guess you could ask, is what does it even mean to write a symphony today? Because so many symphonies of today don't follow the traditional symphonic form. Yes, they may be multi-movements, but, you know, Stephen Stuckey, who recently passed away, I think his last symphony was a single movement work, about 20 minutes long. And so people, you know, are going more singular in terms of one movement, or in my case, multi-movements. And what does that really mean to the listener and to you? And so for me, the term symphony was really more or less about making a statement. And I guess you could say it's my first big statement as a young composer. And for whatever reason, American Symphony, the title, just I could not escape. And I was super uncomfortable with that title for a while, but it never left me. At one point, I just said, I have to accept this. And if people are against it, then so be it. But it means something to me. And so I stuck with it. Now, in terms of that piece coming to life, again, Michael has been such a great champion of mine. I think I called Frank Byrne probably in January of 2009. And obviously I called Michael as well, and I basically said, listen, I'm going to be writing my first symphony. I'm coming to you guys first. I would love for you to commission the symphony. If you don't want to commission it, I'm going to find someone else. And they came back probably a couple weeks later and said, let's do it.
You know, you reference Obama's 08 election. Of course, you know, hope, that was the big word in there. And the piece is very hopeful, which is interesting because I would think, you know, you said how that 08 election, of course, that was now almost 10 years ago, was very, very significant for you in your age group, being that you really were invested in this. I guess what I'm trying to get at is things have changed since then. And, you know, you put in music the way your feelings of really America or being an American is in this work. You can kind of feel it. And I guess you're hoping that this type of thing wins out. I mean, right? I'm trying to read into it. And I don't want to do that because it can be dangerous. But
I don't know. I mean, I never try to project a feeling on a musician who's playing a piece of mine or an audience member who's experiencing a piece of mine. I mean, people tend to tell me that my music is somehow naturally optimistic or uplifting. I'd say generally more uplifting than not. Maybe it's my personality. I don't really know. But yeah, I do think it's a hopeful piece and wants to be an inspiring piece and also a celebratory piece. And yes, we are in a much
different place,
darker time, one could say, right now. I mean, interestingly enough, right around President Trump's inauguration on January 20th, I was in Austin, Texas, working with the University of Texas Wind Ensemble and Jerry Junkin. It's a fabulous wind ensemble group and really my first time diving into the world of band music, although American Symphony and Picture Studies have both been transcribed for band by the president's own United States Marine Band.
Right.
And Jerry Junkin's the person who commissioned John Corigliano's third symphony called Circus Maximus. And so they commissioned my second symphony, and it's one of my darkest works, and it's called Migration.
Okay.
And so it's definitely a reflection of the current time that we're in right now. So yeah, so I guess I wasn't trying to really project anything specific on you, the listener, with American Symphony, except that it's the same philosophy that I tell all my students, which is I think as an artist, it's so important to first and foremost write the music, or in any art form, create art that you 100% believe in, that is full of your integrity and full of your creativity, and that it's something that you ultimately, in terms of music at least, want to listen to. And in turn, if you're being honest with yourself, hopefully that can transcend and others will, you know, have some type of reaction as well, and hopefully a positive reaction. And so, you know, the symphony was something that I needed to write. It's music that I stand by and I believe in, and then it came to life.
And we'll turn to the final work on the new recording of orchestral works by my guest, the opening two movements from his American Symphony. These are titled Fanfare and White on Blue. Michael Stern leads the Kansas City Symphony, music by my guest today, Adam Schoenberg. Thank you. zoom out a bit on your music. It's funny that you say you have students, and I mentioned how you're not 40 yet, and you've got students now who are probably a good 18 years younger than you, something like that. Influences. If you were an American composer 50 years ago, the influences you grew up with, what would influence your composition style, your thought process, your sound world, were very different than what you had as a composer, and what now what your students have is probably different from you. There's probably a little bit of gap even going there.
Sure.
You didn't come to composition late, but you kind of came a little bit late to the idea that you'd be a full-time composer. And even your graduate thesis work was not on one of the great pantheon of classical composers. It was about a very famous film composer, Thomas Newman. So talk about your influences as a composer, because I think that what you talk and the names you mention and whatever might interest our audience to see how different that is than some of these American composers from the past.
Sure. Well, you know, I think every good student, or and that's certainly something I do tell my students at Occidental College where I teach composition and film scoring, is you need to know what has come before you, you know, the good and the bad, and study so many scores. And really, you know, there are great orchestration books. Samuel Adler has one of the best orchestration books out there, and it will become a student's Bible. But all of the pre-existing repertoire that exists, scores and recordings, is the greatest Bible, because you learn from all of these people. But in terms of my specific influences, yeah, I mean, it's pretty eclectic, I would suppose. John Corigliano is a great mentor. I love his Red Violin, the Chaconne, which is part of the film score, but also the first movement of his violin concerto, I think has one of the most gorgeous melodies of the 20th century. I'm a huge fan of Ravel. I think Ravel is one of the greatest orchestrators ever. Of course, I love Stravinsky. I love Gershwin. I recently found out that, yes, I'm not related to Arnold Schoenberg, but Gershwin's great-grandfather was my fourth great-grandfather. So there is a bloodline connection to Gershwin. I've always felt some affinity to his music. But, you know, I'm a product of the 21st century and radio and CDs. You know, I grew up listening to a lot of Tribe Called Quest and Outkast and Jamiroquai and Radiohead and Pat Metheny. And I love the rhythm and energy of that type of music, which in itself there's a spread of different genres that I just listed. But you will somehow find that energy or that harmonic language in my music, but then you'll have a structural form that embodies, you know, I love Samuel Barber. I really obsessed over Stravinsky's Rite of Spring for the longest time. And of course, as I mentioned, Copland's Symphony No. 3. So, you know, these are master composers who are great architects and have a great sense of structure and form. Yet I definitely somehow bring certain pop idioms or music of our time into my orchestral settings, I guess you could say.
And we should put a footnote in here, because I think it's a really fun coincidence that, yes, you are not related, even though your name is spelled, to Arnold Schoenberg. However, you are now in L.A., where Schoenberg was, and actually you're related to Schoenberg's sometimes tennis partner out there, which is George Gershwin. I think that's a hoot. I guess what I'm getting at is, even your young students now, you say, and I applaud you, and that was going to be my next question, is how much do you have to honor the past, and, you know, you, whether you're listening to Stravinsky or Ravel or Debussy or something like that. But when you were figuring out you were going to be a full-time composer, and as your students do now, even if they're interested in film music or whatever it is, in their mix of what they're listening to through their downloads on their phones, whatever, is that stuff really there? Or did you sort of discover all these, what we would call classical great pieces, as you developed? I mean, the pop music side, the film music side, that stuff was kind of there before, is it not? Or am I off base with that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, pop music has been around for a long time, and that was there. And I think any composer in the 50s or 60s growing up would naturally have a Beatles influence and other artists. Interestingly, the main difference for me is, so I teach at a liberal arts college.
Right.
So I actually started composing quite late. I first went to Oberlin College as a college student and joined the men's soccer team, and which I continued to play throughout college. But after my first semester in the college, I then transferred to the conservatory. And first I got into this electronic music program because my composition chops were rather pathetic at the time, although I was a really good improviser and I was always creating music, but I just didn't really know how to notate it well. And then after the first semester of my sophomore year, which was my first year in the conservatory, I officially became a composition major. And so I was late to the game, but I was still at a conservatory. And so I was forced to listen to so much classical rep,
right,
whether it was for a music history class or a theory class or a composition assignment. Whereas today, with the liberal arts students, in order for them to get the music major, first of all, the number of units and credits is almost half the amount that a conservatory student would have to go through. So to me, it's about finding a balance. And so I do give them listening assignments. And, you know, even this week, I was having students listen to Earl Brown, look at graphic scores, which is something so foreign to them. But I think it can open up their sonic world. And then at the same time, you know, I would say, let's look at this piano piece by Ravel and let's see how this could be orchestrated. So it's a matter of each student having his or her own drive and discipline to want to learn about the music of the past. And I can guide them and offer them listening assignments, but it's also balancing just the course load that's required of a liberal arts student. So it's an interesting, I guess, test for me because I want to make them as well-rounded as possible.
I mentioned how you did your grad thesis on Thomas Newman, a very famous film composer. Mostly he's known for his film scores. Again, something you would not have been able to do 50 years ago. They wouldn't have allowed you to do it. But So you've written some film music. You want to concentrate now, I gather, more on concert music, or whether it's orchestral or you know. There is a different audience for those two. And I'm just wondering, because you have had a little success in the film music biz, I mean, if you quote unquote are successful in the film music biz, the exposure to your music is just exponentially more than the number of people that can crowd into a concert hall to hear your piece. There's a difference there between the audiences you're trying to reach and what you'll be happy with, I guess, you know, between those two worlds.
Yeah, they have seemed like disparate worlds for a long time.
Yeah.
But I think now more than ever, there's a bridge being built between the two, and there are many composers who've had a tremendous amount of success working in both worlds. And so I have not given up that dream. My dream since my sophomore year in college has always been to score one film or do a TV show and write one piece for orchestra a year. And that hasn't happened, of course. I've been fortunate enough to have at least one orchestral commission every year. But yeah, it's a different audience for sure. And I do think there's some film music out there that can fit more in a classical or jazz type of genre. I've become friendly with Jeff Beal, who does The House of Cards.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he also did Monk and Ugly Betty back in the day. And here's a composer with serious chops. He's a great jazz trumpeter. And he actually just signed recently, I think a year or two ago, a publishing deal with Schirmer, who publishes Barber and John Crigliano, among others. And so he's someone who's starting to move more fluidly between both worlds. And of course, he was in a position to do that because he was already famous in the film and TV world. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do think that if a film music lover heard my CD, I would hope and think that there's something in there that they could find appealing.
Here are the final minutes from a work commissioned of my guest by Michael Stern and his Iris Orchestra, a concerto for flute, cello, and double bass, with the soloists being the wonderful ensemble and past Cadenza guests, Project Trio, Greg Padilla flute, Eric Stevenson cello, and Peter Seymour double bass. This was recorded live at the Georgetown Performing Arts Center in Georgetown, Tennessee, home of the Iris Orchestra. They are led by Michael Stern. This was recorded back in February 2016. The work is called Scatter, music by my guest today, Adam Schoenberg. We mentioned him at the beginning of the broadcast, but I mean, to have someone like Maestro Michael Stern champion your music, and he does. I mean, it was evident when we did the broadcast that he thinks very much of, highly of your music. But that's kind of an invaluable thing for a composer. I'm just curious how you got on his radar. I mean, you're thankful you did, but how did that happen? Because you've got a very staunch supporter there.
Yeah, he's been very good to me, and we also have a good friendship. And at the end of the day, he gets my music.
Yeah.
That means a lot because he's a deep musician, and I like that he can feel deeply when he's diving into my music. It was sort of this fortuitous type of situation where the stars were aligned. I was a student for several summers at the Aspen Music Festival and school in Aspen, Colorado. And I also, for a couple of summers, decided to stick around and work as a stagehand, which really taught me about the back end of the business and how much goes on behind the scenes in order to make an orchestral production happen. And it gave me an incredible amount of respect to all the stage managers and, of course, music librarians. And I think that's actually helped me from a business side, just in terms of my relationships when I go work with orchestras. But as I said, I was a soccer player. I'm also a tennis player. And word got around that I was a decent tennis player. And Michael approached me one day and said, "Do you want to hit?" And of course, I said yes. And so we started playing tennis regularly for one of the summers. And then at the end of the summer, he asked where I was off to in the fall. And I said, "Oh, I'm going to do my master's at Juilliard." And he said, "Let me hear your music." So I sent him my music. And then a few months later, I got a commission.
I love how tennis has come back into the mix here. Sometimes about Gershwin playing with your namesake, yeah. Arnold Schoenberg. Well, last thing, and some composers don't like to do this with me, if you have superstitions, but I'm wondering, what's ahead? I mean, I've got this orchestral CD in front of me here, so what are you working on that you could let out of the bag, as it were? What's coming from your pen?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. Contracts have been signed, and orchestras are announcing their seasons. So I have this second symphony that's going to be premiered on March 5th with Jerry Junkin and the University of Texas Wind Ensemble. They will then take it on tour. They'll also record it with reference recordings.
Great.
And it's going to end the College Band Directors National Association Convention in Kansas City on March 18th. So all the band directors in the country will hear this piece, which will be a really fun experience. And then I am going to be writing so it's funny how I wrote this triple concerto for Project Trio, and that's the first concerto I ever wrote. My next concerto is going to be a double concerto for two pianos. And that was commissioned by the Dranoff International Two Piano Foundation out in Miami. It's an international competition that happens every 4 years, and this concerto will be the final round of the competition.
Okay, great.
That will premiere in December of 2017. And then I'm writing a violin concerto for Anne Akiko Myers that the San Diego Symphony will premiere in February of 2018.
You've worked the concerto route backwards.
I know, it's pretty funny.
Well, I wish you continued success and look forward to more of your stuff being available. If it's still going to be on the ancient, antiquated medium of CD, that's great. But, you know, just that it's available, people could hear it and pick it up. And hopefully some in our area here are, you know, we span New York City down through Philadelphia, one of the richest veins of music in the country. Hopefully we'll hear some music from you in this area too as well. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. The first question is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat, like we've been doing, with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to, when I ask that question, what's the first name that popped into your head? Can't think about it too long, you get swamped, but...
Copeland.
It would be Aaron Copeland, huh? Is there just an affinity there for the Americanism of what he was able to establish?
Yeah, I mean, I really think he truly created or helped create this American sound along with Bernstein and, you know, Ives to a degree, but really Bernstein and maybe Gershwin a little, but Copeland for sure. And my music is very different, but I really feel like I am an extension of this American composer idiom.
Yeah, good. I can see that. Yeah, sure. Final question is a non-musical question. You've already thrown out a couple things here, but I ask my guests, you know, everybody I interview on Cadenza is very busy with music. You're not only writing, you're now teaching and all the rest of that. But when you have to get away from music, something non-musical, take your mind off it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, I gather you are risking your body on sports. But what do you do to get away? I mean, I know you've got little ones at home, but still, you know.
Yeah, but for the little ones, it's enough exercise. I still play tennis. Actually, my new favorite sport, which is a West Coast sport, it's called paddle tennis. On the East Coast, it's called platform tennis, but it's fenced in. On the West Coast, it's like between tennis and ping pong, where it's a small tennis court with a smaller net. You use a punctured tennis ball so it doesn't bounce as much. And I think you use more of a small fiberglass type of racket. And exact same rules as tennis. It's a great workout, and it's something that I love to play.
Okay. Is that a hard surface, too?
Yeah, it's a hard surface. Well, yep.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Are you still playing soccer? You said on and off, right?
No, not. I had so many injuries. So Occidental, I joined the faculty intramural team where we just get annihilated by the college students.
Yeah.
And that's fun, but no, I don't really play that much anymore.
Well, Adam Schoenberg, thanks for taking some time.
Hey, thanks so much for your time as well.
Composer Adam Schoenberg. You can find out more about him at his website, Adam Schoenberg. Schoenberg spelled S-C-H-O-E-N-B-E-R-G. The new recording, from which we've sampled this hour, of his orchestral works performed by the Kansas City Symphony, led by their music director Michael Stern, is on the Reference Recordings label. Check that out at referencerecordings.com. I'll leave you with the final movements from his musical tour through the Art Museum, his piece called Picture Studies. We'll hear a short interlude, followed by a short movement, Cliffs of Moher, inspired by Hiroshi Sugimoto's photograph, and then the final movement, Pigeons in Flight, inspired by Francis Blake's photograph of the same name. Music by my guest today, Adam Schoenberg. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to WWFM and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.